Last month, President Donald Trump announced that he is ordering federal agencies to rebuild and reopen Alcatraz. Yes, that notorious maximum security prison that closed more than 60 years ago. It used to house America's ruthless and violent offenders. It's now a currently a tourist attraction. Many of you probably have gone to see it. I'm not sure if this is a practical thing, but I did want to discuss the facility. And with us is a person who is the foremost expert on the prison, author Jolene Babiak. She actually grew up on Alcatraz. She's the author of Breaking the Rock, The Great Escape from Alcatraz, Birdman, The Many Faces of Robert Stroud. And fun fact, she is going to tell us some fun facts about what it's really like to grow up there. Jolene, thank you so much for joining us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And I'm going to have Sylvia Perez, who is a local anchor on our Fox affiliate, is going to join us. She was in our first segment, and she was so fascinated by Alcatraz that she wants to listen in and maybe ask you some questions. So, first of all, can you just tell our listeners who may not know where Alcatraz is and what it is, just a little bit about the facility and its history?
Sure. It's about a mile and a quarter off of San Francisco, California, and it's about 3 miles from the Golden Gate Bridge and about 5 miles to the Bay Bridge, so it's more or less in the middle of the bay, and it was a federal prison, so a lot of people are surprised at the types of crimes that are represented there, but they're federal crimes: bank robbery, kidnapping, crossing state lines with stolen goods, income tax evasion. That's how you got the big gangsters in the old days, and the drug dealers maybe today. Timothy McVeigh bombed the federal building in Oklahoma City. That was a federal murder charge. But murder and physically violent men committing crimes against women and children, that's mostly a state crime, or those are mostly state crimes. So the crimes don't look that serious. The other thing to remember, and the most important thing, I think, is that men didn't come to Alcatraz because of their crimes. They came there because of their behavior in other federal prisons.
And I've read that it's the incorrigible that ended up there, people who needed an attitude adjustment. Is that fair to say?
Well, yeah. A lot of times they were mentally ill. I mean, I think about 40% of the population was seriously mentally ill, from functional all the way up to schizophrenia. Wow. And, oftentimes they kind of get drawn into crime by their buddies and they're good drivers, and they might wait there while the crime is being committed and then drive away. But they tend to act out in the courtroom, and they often get worse sentences. And then when they get to prison, they act out because, you know, they're emotionally unstable, and they end up in a prison like Alcatraz. So it's probably still true today that people who act up, I mean, I always suggest that people think about when you're in the sixth grade in public school and the kids that are getting sent down to the principal's office because they're talking back at the teachers or they're acting out in some way. And pretty soon by the eighth grade, you know, they're being expelled or suspended. And then by the time you're in high school, they're serving time in juvie. And then they never quite learn their lesson. They always try to escape, or they mouth off, or they have, you know, they try to stab people, and they consistently get into more and more trouble. And so, yeah, attitude adjustment is part of it. A lot of it is just impulse, and sometimes people grow out of that. Sometimes they don't.
You know, I want to talk, Jolene, a little bit about your childhood in Alcatraz. How is it that you came to grow up there? And when were we talking? Was this in the 1960s, right?
I wish.
Oh.
I came there when I was 7 in 1954. My dad was transferred. He was actually forced into the job by the Depression. And your listeners will recognize this in their own families. People did what they had to do, and my dad graduated from college in 1933, but there were no full-time jobs. And by 1938, he took a job with the U.S. Bureau of Prisons. And then I think he thought he was going to ride out the war and or ride out the Depression, but the war hit, and so he ended up staying in the field. And he was transferred out there in 1954, and I was 7. But we were living on an island with about 65 other families, about 75 kids, and all of the kids went to school in San Francisco. So I lived there for about a year and a half, 2 years, when I was 7 to 9, and then another, we moved to the city, and my dad continued working there. But my parents preferred living in the city.
Well, I can imagine, yeah.
Yeah. And so, then in 1961, he became the associate warden, and we had to come back.
Oh.
So that was wonderful for me.
Wait a minute. I have to ask you, Jolene. This is Sylvia Perez. You came back. How did you feel about having to move back there?
Oh, I was thrilled.
Why?
It was really fun because there were so many kids on the island because we traveled by boat to the city. So we had friends in the city. We could bring kids over. I mean, you couldn't bring your whole classroom over, but you could bring kids over.
And talk about show and tell.
Field trip.
Field trip. Yeah, right.
Oh, my gosh. It was really fun. And, you know, here's the other thing is that the community really paid a lot of attention to the kids. So everybody felt connected and, you know, they really paid a lot of attention to us. So we were living in a little cocoon, but you could go to the city. The boat ran from 15 or 20 times a day.
Jolene, we only have a few minutes before I need to take a break, but you really weren't supposed to interact with the inmates. I know that, right? Yeah, but, you know, but you did see them, and there were some interactions just inadvertent. Can you tell our listeners maybe about a particular time that you interacted with the inmates?
Yeah, there was a couple of prisoners cleaning up, probably cutting back the shrubbery, and I wasn't paying any attention to them, but one of them found a little handball. And the handballs were really cool. I already knew this. You know, I'd only lived on the island maybe 6 months or something, but the handballs were really cool because they came from prisoners. And so he showed me the one he'd found, and, you know, I'm sure my eyes got really big, and I looked at the guard, and he nodded to me, and I walked over to the fence, and this guy knelt down and pushed it through the cyclone fence to me, thereby making me the coolest kid on the island that day.
So you have a permanent bad boy complex, is that right?
And then I had this huge dilemma, which is a word that I did not know, but I knew how it felt, which was you were not allowed to talk to a prisoner, but you were supposed to be polite to an adult.
Right.
So
got to be respectful. So that taught you a lesson, I guess. Let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about some fun facts, that maybe some things people don't know about Alcatraz. See if you have any stories about our homeboy, Al Capone. And I want to talk about the escape from Alcatraz. Was it really an escape?
Okay.
And I want to hear your opinion on that. I'm talking right now to Jolene Babiak. She is the author of Breaking the Rock, The Great Escape, and Alcatraz, The Birdman from Alcatraz, The Many Faces of Robert Stroud. And we're here with Sylvia Perez, who's also asking some questions. We are talking to Jolene Babiak, who had the interesting experience of growing up on Alcatraz. She is the author of Breaking the Rock, The Great Escape, and Birdman, The Many Faces of Robert Stroud. Jolene, thank you so much. And we're here with Sylvia Perez, who has hung on here and is fascinated by the story.
Yeah,
let's talk a little bit about the escape. So can you tell our listeners the history of perhaps just the quick history of the attempts to escape before the one that is probably the most widely publicized?
Right. Well, there was 14 escape attempts overall, and this was the number 13th.
Love it.
And Morris and Alan West and John and Clarence Anglin dug through their wall. They opened a vent at the back of their wall and got into a utility corridor and used the pipes as a ladder and got to the top of the block. And then over a period of about 6 weeks, they worked on a ceiling vent up there. And they also built masks to put in their beds so that it would look like they were still sleeping. And then on the night of the escape, June 11, 1962, they put the masks on their beds, crawled through, climbed at the top, and broke through the ceiling vent. Probably about half an hour, maybe 45 minutes after a bunch of us kids went home for the evening because we had been playing softball on the parade ground. And so about 45 minutes later, they got up on top of the roof and escaped from Alcatraz and were never seen again.
Wow.
So actually, this week, strangely, is like the 63rd anniversary of this escape. And
right.
So, and I just love the pictures because, you know, they actually use real hair from the barbershop, right, to make the masks.
Well, Clarence Anglin worked in the barbershop, so he just pocketed the hair from the floor, probably.
Wow.
Interesting. So so they get away, and what do they use? Do they use some sort of life raft, as I recall? Was it like...
Yeah, they used raincoats, and they were old Navy issue raincoats. They were a cotton backed with rubber, and I'm sure that prisoners, you know, held the raincoats under their faucet to see if they held water, and they did. They were pretty bulky and voluminous, and so they made life jackets out of them, and they also made a raft. No one ever saw the raft. Alan West, who stayed behind, he described it. There was a piece left behind. We don't know what kind of glue they used. We know part of it was hand-stitched, but no one ever... It was said to be pontoons. It was said to be about 6 feet by 4 feet. We don't know if it had a floor. It probably did, but we don't know, right, because it was never really seen. And we don't know how seaworthy it was.
And the water surrounding Alcatraz is treacherous. It's cold. The current is bad. There are sharks. I mean, it's a very dangerous expedition. What did they find that was left of this escape? Weren't there certain pieces of items left behind or actually on shore?
Yeah, there was Alan West didn't go, so there was a paddle or there was a life jacket left behind, and that matched two life jackets that ended up being fished out of the bay. There was a paddle left behind. It probably flew out of their hand when they were running, and that matched a paddle that was found in the bay. And there was a packet of photographs of the same material that they used to make the raft, a packet of photographs from the Anglin family. You know, a lot of them identified on the back. They were waterlogged, but they were able to fish them out and look at them. And so that's something that the Anglins would have never let go.
Jolene, I have to ask you, because for those who have not been to Alcatraz, Karen just described the surroundings, and those of us who have gone, since it's now a tourist destination, know you look at it, it's cold, it's clammy, and you talk about people there who had mental health issues, and then they were put in that environment. Can you paint a picture of what Alcatraz was like then, and why it was such a big deal to even be able to attempt to escape from there?
Well, the bay, you know, wasn't, there were sharks in the bay, but they weren't mostly man-eating sharks. There are occasionally what great
nice sharks. They were nice sharks.
Yeah, they're nice sharks. They're not as dangerous as your average six-year-old child, is what I always say. Leopard sharks, we used to hook them all the time and bring them on the island.
Goodness.
And I guess somebody ate them. I didn't. But, you know.
See, I grew up in Kentucky Fried Chicken. She grew up on shark. I don't know.
Right. Yeah.
But still, it was the environment itself.
Yeah, you know, like the prison itself, it wasn't very nice, was it? I mean, I know there are, I think, is it fair to say that some of the prisoners liked the prison because it was one person to a cell, which was safer? But as a rule, like, it was kind of a cold, horrible place, right?
Well, yeah, definitely it was cold. The military built the thing, and they put their yard in the worst, you know, half acre that you could possibly imagine. It was windswept, and 3 miles away was the Golden Gate Bridge. So it was very, very inhospitable, and you always went to the yard with your jackets on. The island itself was clean. I mean, there were many prisons that were much worse. We're talking mid-century. Poor states had usually one maximum security prison. It was always overcrowded. The food wasn't good, you know, and in some of the poorer states, the food was worse than palatable. Alcatraz was known for having really good food. It was one man, one cell, and you went to the yard with maybe 125 other prisoners instead of 1,000. You didn't eat in a big dining room with 1,000 other prisoners. So, I mean, some people actually liked it. It was boring. That was the biggest problem. It was incredibly boring because every day was just like the last. That was the problem.
So let's talk about this escape or potential escape with the three inmates. So this happened right in the 1960s, correct?
Right, 62.
So 62. So flash ahead to the 2013, 2014, and what happens? I want to hear your opinion on what this is all about.
Well, I don't know if you're talking about the letter.
The letter.
The FBI.
Yes.
The letter.
The
well,
letter.
You know, here's my take on those letters. By the time...
Well, tell our listeners what it was, what happened, because I don't think people remember.
It was purportedly written by John Anglin, who said, you know, I'm John Anglin, I'm sick, I'm dying, I want to come forward, and my brother died, and I think it was about 2008, and Clarence died, Frank Morris died in 2001. But this is the deal. The FBI probably get letters like this all the time. If there's something in the letter that you can corroborate, if there's a date, if you say Frank Morris died in Chicago, Illinois on June 20th, 1902, if you have a date there that can be corroborated by the FBI, they're going to take that letter much more seriously. But if there's nothing in the letter, and there wasn't, that could be independently checked, then they're not even going to take that letter very seriously, because they get stuff like this all the time. And there was nothing in the letter that could be independently verified. And so that's not a lead.
Yeah. Well, and I assume they did some handwriting analysis, probably didn't come up with anything on that. But so if you're a betting person, what do you say? Do you think there was a successful escape? Do you think this was a true and accurate?
You remember me saying that you men came there for their behavior.
Right.
If you think of Alcatraz at the top of the pyramid, it was the smallest penitentiary in the system, and it was very hard to get there. Martha Stewart went to a level one, and you would too if you committed the same crime she committed and it was your first crime. You'd go to a level one where you could probably have a visitor at least every day and maybe every week, therapy, you know, AA, and all kinds of classes and cooking and whatever. But if you messed up in that level one, you went into a level two and a level three and a level four. Well, Alcatraz was a level six. It was the only level six. And so it was a very small little penitentiary. When guys like that escape from a prison like that, they tend to be noticeable. And here's the scenario that I always suggest. You can steal a car, but it's going to run out of gas. Once it runs out of gas, you have a second problem. Now, you either have to get another car, and if you do that, now there's a trail. We know where the first car went, ended up, and we now know that there's a second car, and they can more or less tell where you're going, and that becomes an easier problem. You still don't have food. You still don't have a gun. You still don't have money, you know.
Well, it's like these people who escaped in, was it Louisiana just recently? Mm-hmm. You know, they're going to go right to the family members, right? Because they know the family's going to give them, you know, comfort and give them their money and all of that. And,
and that's
going to be...
And that's a felony.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now that's a felony.
Yes.
So that's a problem. Yeah, and then they just caught that guy who was the sheriff, right? He was out.
Yes.
You know... And he was not even that far away from the prison. He was only about a mile away or something. You know, my favorite escape happened, I think, in Virginia State Prison about a year or two ago, and they ended up at the IHOP.
Sylvia, you could have recommended a better breakfast place than that.
Yeah. I know. I'm still stuck on the fact that she said the food was good at Alcatraz.
No, the food was good.
It's like the IHOP escape.
Jolene, isn't it true that the food was good there because one of the wardens said that one of the worst, you know, one of the reasons that prisoners acted up was because they rebelled against the bad food. So he said, if we have good food, we're going to have fewer uprisings.
Incidences. Yeah, that was Warden Johnson. Early in his career, he'd been sent to San Quentin because there was a riot involving 2,000 men over the quality of the food. And he straightened that out, and he brought 20 years later, he brought that theory to Alcatraz. And the food was good. They had pork chops and ribeye.
Shark.
You know.
Nice shark.
Jolene Babiak, thank you so much for joining us here. It was too short. Breaking the Rock, The Great Escape, and Birdman, The Many Faces of Robert Stroud. Please join us again, and I'm sure you have more stories about Alcatraz, but thank you so much for joining us. You take care of yourself.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right.
Thank
take you, care. Jolene.